This is the bathroom that I hid in with my family 30 years ago to escape a mob who wanted to burn the house down and kill us. They were targeting us because we were Sikh. After Indira Gandhi's assassination, revenge attacks started all over Delhi against Sikhs.
I felt a blow on the back of my neck and my turban came off, and I had a few more blows on my back. Suddenly, for the first time in my life, I was hunted. It really felt like that. And the next 3 days, you really felt you were being hunted.
That's Professor Swaran Singh. We were both in Delhi in 1984. He was living there and I was visiting my relatives.
BBC News at 9 o'clock on Wednesday, the 31st of October. The Indian Prime Minister, Mrs. Indira Gandhi, has been assassinated.
It's thought that the two security guards who shot Mrs. Gandhi were Sikhs.
Following the assassination of Indira Gandhi, days of rioting broke out. Buildings were set on fire and mobs of Hindus went on the rampage looking for members of the Sikh community to attack and murder. What I experienced during those days, I've buried and blocked out of my memory. As a 13-year-old back then, it was difficult to explain. But now, 30 years on, I'm back in Delhi to retrace my steps. I'm Bobby Friction. You're listening to the BBC World Service. Assassination, when Delhi burned. I'm on my way now to Lajpat Nagar, which is basically where my family were staying in the late 70s, early 80s, and some of them are still here now. It's where I spent my childhood whenever we visited India. And I got to know this place like the back of my hand. I'm okay, we got lost. I'm just gonna take you into the house now, because I was downstairs, just beyond this door I'm about to open. I was down here when we realized that there was a mob advancing. And I totally remember being here, actually on these steps, when every window in the house smashed. And I could hear my mum screaming out my name. And my mum was in this bathroom. And we were in here, seven of us. And we closed the door and we locked it. And that was it. And that's when I realized something really serious was happening. And then my cousin brother said, I need to go outside, someone's knocking. And that's when he opened the door and he looked out of the window and there was a friend of his going, come down, come down.
After a heated debate between the adults on whether it was safe to leave, we did go down. My cousin Romy's Hindu friend led us into a house. All the Sikhs in our area were crammed into it like sardines. Our Hindu neighbours had sheltered all the Sikh families in the area. We were the lucky ones.
Indira Gandhi was taken to hospital after she'd been shot by two of her own security guards. One fired a Sten gun at Mrs. Gandhi at point-blank range as she was walking through her garden. The other fired a revolver. One of the guards was killed by commandos, the other was wounded.
After the Prime Minister was shot, she was rushed here to the All India Institute of Medical Sciences, known as AIIMS, in South Delhi. And it's here where Professor Swaran Singh's story begins. In 1984, he was a trainee surgeon in Delhi.
I was in the hospital across, Safdarjung Hospital, and I had come in the morning to prepare for the ward round. Now this looks very different now, but it was a much narrower road. So I rushed across and I came and I went into All India Institute and the crowd was already building up. I went all the way as close as I could to the A&E department where she was.
Did you just want to have a look or were you trying to help?
I think we were all, everybody there was in a state of shock. And I lingered just trying to find out what had happened.
Indira Gandhi was shot at 9:20 a.m. By the afternoon, it was reported that the Prime Minister was dead.
Apparently, the BBC had reported it, and everybody wanted the BBC to confirm because nobody believed the local media. A colleague of mine came up to me And he said, it's not going to be safe for Sikhs. So I walked across and someone said, Ye raha Sardar, ye hai the Sikh. And I felt a blow on the back of my neck. And my turban came off. And I had a few more blows on my back. And I rushed through as much as I could. And there was an auto rickshaw on the other side. I got in. I remember I was shaking. I mean, my knees were trembling. I thought I was going to fall. And I said, get me out of here. I got home. And there was complete chaos. The whole country seemed to be at a standstill. So my first sense was horror. In my growing up in India, I'd heard about violence, I'd heard about religious riots, I'd heard about ethnic killings. But Delhi had been different. Delhi was different, and people like me weren't targets.
But the Sikh community did become a target. Mrs. Gandhi's bodyguards, Beant Singh and Satwant Singh, carried out the assassination in revenge for an attack on the Golden Temple, the Sikhs' holiest shrine in Amritsar. Indira Gandhi was at the time waging a campaign against militants in the Punjab, led by Janail Singh Bindranwala. Things came to a head when Bindranwala and his followers took refuge inside the Golden Temple and refused to surrender. Indira Gandhi then ordered her army in to forcibly remove the militants in June 1984. What followed was a very bloody clash in which many lost their lives, including civilians visiting the temple that day. Bindranwala was also killed. 4 months after the attack on the Golden Temple, known as Operation Blue Star, Indira Gandhi was also murdered in revenge. Mark Tully was the BBC's India correspondent during 1984. Today, he still lives in India.
I don't think Indira Gandhi knew she was going too far when she ordered the army to go into the Golden Temple, because the army had given her the impression that it would be a simple, quick operation. But after it was over, yes, I think Indira Gandhi was very much shattered by what had happened for India. And I am sure that she felt that I must not in any way be separated from the Sikh community, because they are such an important part of India. And so she refused to accept the advice that she should not have Sikhs in her bodyguard. It was her way of making herself feel that she had not lost the affection of the Sikh community, and bringing herself to believe that what had happened in Blue Star had not divorced her from that community.
Indira Gandhi had dominated Indian politics for 19 years. Within 8 hours of her assassination, her eldest son, Rajiv Gandhi, had been sworn in as her successor. By the late evening of the 31st of October, and by the following morning, those of us in the capital woke up to a burning Delhi. My family's Sikh temple, our Gurdwara in Lajpat Nagar, had been set on fire. In surrounding areas, vehicles and Sikh houses and businesses were being targeted.
Angry crowds have already attacked Sikhs and burnt buses.
A mob of hooligans is standing outside the house of a Sikh, and they're throwing stones in. They're throwing chairs, everything they can lay their hands in.
India's new Prime Minister went on national television to say the violence needed to stop.
Incidents of arson, loot and murder have taken place.
But the violence continued in large parts of Delhi and intensified from the 1st of November until the army was finally brought in.
In one incident, 12 people were dragged from a train and clubbed to death.
I saw one dead body, badly mauled, almost unrecognisable, lying on the tracks right below the platform.
For Swaran, who's now medical director at Warwick University and a consultant psychiatrist, being back in Delhi with me is an emotional roller coaster. I was shielded from the attacks and bloodshed. He wasn't.
Suddenly, for the first time in my life, I was hunting. It really felt like that. And the next 3 days, you really felt you were being hunted.
Like animals?
Like animals. This is where I was born. This is where I grew up. This is where I lived. This was home. Till then, it was home. It was sanctuary.
By now, thousands of Sikhs had become refugees in their own city, and many had been killed. The official figure is at least 3,000, but many say it's far higher. Once the army moved in, law and order was finally restored.
Swaran, how do you feel about Delhi now?
When I think of Delhi and I think of India, I cannot forget 84.
Many of the Sikhs, now homeless, took shelter in the temporary relief camps that had been set up. Large numbers of them ended up in Tilak Vihar, a rundown area on the western side of Delhi. For the first few days and months, Swaran was dropping off blankets, food and medicines at Tilak Vihar. A few months later, he found out about a group of volunteers who were working with the women there. He decided to focus on the children.
The widows in Tilak Vihar were in a perpetual state of mourning. So the widows were so absorbed in their own grief that nobody was paying attention to the children. So I thought we will start giving these kids to our play area. And of course they wouldn't come because they were terrified. So then we decided we will run a clinic. So I said all the children who come to our play area will get free health care, free advice and free medication. And so then they started coming. And two or three times a week, mostly on a Saturday and Sunday, go there and just look after those children. And when I started working with the victims, the child victims, I saw things that, and heard things that haunted me for years, really haunted me. I couldn't sleep at night. I left Delhi, never wanting to come back.
Swaran, is there any sense within you that they were abandoned by you?
You know, when I did it for 2 years, we ran out of steam, you know. Nobody ever asked me this before. I've never thought of it before. If I'm really honest, I ran away.
So 30 years on now, those kids are going to be grown up, adults, members of Indian society. Do you want to find them?
I do. I want to know that they survived. I want to know that they came out of it.
We're now on our way to Tilak Vihar, and today it's become the permanent home for many of the Sikh families who survived the violence and the killings in Delhi. In fact, so many of the women living here were widows, it soon became known as the Widow's Colony. This is the first time in 30 years you're going back.
That's right. Yeah, I am.
And how are you feeling right now?
I'm worried that we never find them. There's one boy in particular I am really desperate to find, and he would get into a rage, then climb onto the rooftop of this high-rise apartments and threatened to jump. And I remember him screaming, "Find the man who killed my father or I'm going to jump."
So what was the name of this boy?
His name was Ajinder.
I also had a surprise for Swaran. I'd arranged for one of the volunteers who'd worked alongside Swaran in the makeshift clinic to also meet us at Tilak Vihar, Meeta Bose. Swaran hasn't seen her since he left India.
There she is.
There she is. Hiya. Hi.
Oh, wow. Dr. Swaran.
How are you?
So how are you doing?
I'm all right. Haven't we changed? We have changed. And I just can't believe I'm back here.
Look here. Here I can show you all your diaries.
You kept it all along?
Yes, and I've got the account of the work we did day by day.
Gosh, I never thought I'd see this again. But that's my handwriting.
This is a list. This is a list of all of the children that you treated.
Yeah, and this is one day. This is just one day.
The first day you met them. See, But I want to be permitted about Swaran to say something, because I have here an account of the first day I met Swaran, and I just want to read out four lines. We got to Tilak Vihar at 10:30 a.m. and found Dr. Swaran waiting for us at Vishal restaurant since 10 a.m. He turned out to be the most alert, serious, involved and sympathetic young man in his role as visiting voluntary doctor to Tilak Vihar. I'm very hopeful about his contribution to our project.
I never knew this.
I think you should learn how to take a very beautiful compliment.
Okay.
I think we need to take you guys towards that block of flats and get you to retrace your steps.
Okay, let's go.
I'm now inside one of these blocks of flats inside Tilak Vihar, inside the Widow's Colony, and the building's crumbling. There's holes in the wall. The whole building seems to be falling apart, and it's very dark and very oppressive as well. We've come to a building that Professor Swaran Singh actually recognizes, and we've been invited into a house where we've met Ganga Kaur, who as a young girl saw absolute horror during those nights in
1984.
We suddenly heard a lot of noise. They shouted for my father to come outside. We went outside to see what's going on. They led him to the corner. My mother shouted and I shouted back for him to return. We saw a group of men. They were hitting him with sticks. They poured petrol all over him and lit a match. We screamed and screamed. The mob then fled. We couldn't save our father.
Who were the actual people who did this?
Their faces were all covered. They were carrying sticks and cans of petrol.
I just want to know what you were hearing.
Kill them, kill them. Kill the Sikhs. They shouldn't be left alive. By the time we returned home, there was chaos. Everyone was screaming and shouting, saying we all had to hide. My mother and I got separated from my grandmother and three younger brothers.
Eventually, Ganga and her mother were taken to one of the refugee camps, and she was reunited with her grandmother and brothers. All three had had their turbans removed and had had their hair cut to conceal their Sikh identity. For many of the Orthodox Sikhs, this alone would have been so traumatic. Ganga, now married with her own children, wasn't one of the children who visited Swaran's makeshift camp. We spent the next few hours visiting the women. One after another, they told us their harrowing stories. Husbands and teenage sons were dragged out of their houses, beaten. Kerosene or petrol was poured over them, and they were then set alight. Young boys were dressed in girls' dresses to hide their identity as the mobs were targeting predominantly men and teenage boys. Large numbers of them never found the bodies of their loved ones. I also heard loud and clear their cries for justice. All of the women I spoke to said those responsible for killing their loved ones were still free. And it's this issue, the need for justice and the truth, that keeps 1984 alive for so many Sikhs in India and around the world. Days after the riots, more and more stories were also emerging of the true horror and the extent of the killings that had taken place. What was also being uncovered was that some of the police failed to stop the violence.
Increasing concern that the police didn't do enough to control the violence after Mrs. Gandhi's murder. New evidence of that violence is coming to light every day. The burnt out wrecks of food.
But even more damning for the government was that evidence started to emerge, pointing the finger at some members of the ruling Congress Party, even some MPs who then went on to become ministers. Historian Professor Uma Chakravarti, now a retired lecturer from Delhi University, was involved in one of the very first reports.
There has been a consistent demand for justice, which has never properly been met. In 4 days, we had actually gone to many resettlement, many camps, spoken to people, and we produced the first report. And that report was called "Who Are the Guilty?" He actually made it very clear that there were X number of congressmen who were directly implicated in stirring up the riots. It was planned. It had negative consequences, quote unquote, negative consequences in one sense, because there were these people who were supposed to be the government, who were supposed to form, you know, be the protectors, and they were all implicated. But the good thing that it did was to say that, look, it's not the entire people who have targeted us. And that was positive. So in that sense, I think there were no retaliatory riots, for instance.
Over the years, there have been a number of inquiries into the 1984 riots, and there are ongoing court cases. But there are claims that no one of any significance has been brought to justice.
There are a few people who were convicted. Some of them have served time. They came out on bail. Some were also punished, but they were always people who were not directly in the chain of command to indict a few people at the bottom.
It will remain a blot on the record of the courts, courts of India and the governments of India, and on the Congress Party in particular, because A, it's been in power mainly since Blue Star, and some of the people who are accused of leading the riots are prominent members of the Congress Party.
And today, there are calls for renewed investigations, a new inquiry which might lead to more convictions. Meanwhile, we were no closer to finding any of the children of 1984 who recognised Swaran, let alone trying to find Harjinder, who Swaran was desperate to find. Exhausted and ready to leave, we decided we'd return in 2 days' time to try and continue our search. Just as we were leaving, we were called into the flat opposite. A woman claimed she'd been treated by a young Sikh doctor in 1984.
I am Nirmal Singh. I used to go to camp with my friend Daman. Yes, we used to play. I do remember you, the doctor. I'm Gurmeet. I remember the camp and playing. I remember Meeta more, as she was with us all the week.
I really don't know what to say.
During this time, you gave us hope. It was really lovely. We felt you cared. You looked after us. We had you and we had Meeta, madam.
You wanted to know how the children of 84 felt, and you wanted to know that something that you did made a difference. You just heard what he said. How do you feel?
Well, I can't tell you how important this moment is for me. You could say that I've been waiting to hear this for 30 years. It's probably one of the most important sentences I've heard in my life. It's just proof that even small bits help. No matter how tragic the circumstances, even small bits help. And one's got to hold on to that. Sorry.
We stopped recording to give Swaran a few moments to catch his breath and to take in what he'd just experienced. The men continued to talk to us. All of them were now aged between 36 years and 43 years old, all married with their own children. And we asked them, what was their life like today?
Today, look at our situation. We just auto rickshaw drivers. Now we are struggling to pay the fee for our children's school. If 1984 hadn't happened, we would have had a better future. Some of us got into bad ways. We did things we shouldn't have. A lot of us took drugs, alcohol as we got older. Our mothers had to go out to work. We were left on our own. Some of the boys and our friends, committed suicide.
This was really upsetting to hear.
There's a lot which suggests that things are not only getting worse, that this is going to be intergenerational, and the effect is going to carry on through to the next generation and perhaps the one after that.
It was time to go, and just before we left, Swaran asked if anyone remembered Harjinder. They said they'd make some inquiries. In the end, we never found Harjinder.
Swaran, you really wanted to find him. We didn't.
I really wish I had, and I just wanted to know that he made it, he was okay. And I don't think I'll ever meet him, but if he ever hears this, I want him to know that he was loved.
For me and Swaran, this has been a profound journey. He managed to resolve many of his issues. The work that he did with the children in 1984 did make a difference. For me, it's been important to go back and finally talk about what happened. I'll never forget meeting Gurmeet and Nirmal, the women, Ganga Kaur, and I just hope that one day they all get the justice they deserve. I'm Bobby Friction. You've been listening to Assassination When Delhi Burned. The producer was Perminder Katkar.
Coming soon.